I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Brian, and we're back with another episode of Stream Close Up. Before we get to this week's guest, I want to take a moment and say thank you. Thank you to everyone who's found us again after the long break. It really means a lot. A little housekeeping before we get started. Remember, you can follow Stream Close Up on Instagram and Facebook at Stream Close Up. You can reach out via Gmail, streamcloseup@gmail. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm the Brian Laffin. Don't be fooled by imitations. So that's the Brian Laffin on Twitter, at Stream Close Up on Facebook and Instagram. Don't forget to subscribe, follow, share, tell your friends, rate, review, yada, 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 you know the drill. All right, let's get to the fun part. Among other things, our guest today will talk about the process, experience, and challenges of NYU Film School. She'll tell us a little bit about her journey from making coffee for a company producing industrial films to directing period pieces like the feature Simon and the Oaks. We'll talk about her successful collaboration with actor Krister Henriksen, and of course, her recent work on the beloved Beck franchise. In for her Stream Close-Up, Lisa Olien. Hit it, Jose. Show, Lisa Olien.
Thank you.
Writer, director, you describe yourself as a visual storyteller. You're in the news right now because you're helming the latest releases in the Beck franchise. And we'd like to take time to get to know you and talk about what that means. I mean, I think there's some historic elements to the fact that you're the first woman directing that franchise. I have some questions around what that means. Just in terms of background, you're from New York originally?
Originally, I'm from New York. My father was a Globetrotter, so we moved a lot. And then I ended up in Sweden for my formative years, I would say. I moved back to Washington, D.C. when I was 16. Came back to Sweden, started working a day job in film while I was painting. And then I quickly realized that film was more fun than painting.
Can I ask, what was that day job?
It was making coffee and paying the bills at a production company that made industrials.
Okay, but you were seeing the process. You were seeing storytelling.
I was seeing the process, and very quickly I was asked to be the driver on productions, and then I ended up starting logging the material, and then I started doing production planning, and then I started realizing that it's kind of, film is kind of like painting but with dialogue.
Some more dimensions.
Yeah.
So you decide that this is what your path is, and you want to move from the industrials to more dramatic work, and you decide to go to school. Is that how you follow your path?
Yeah, exactly. That's when I decided to go to pursue my master's in film.
And you did that at NYU?
Yeah, I ended up at NYU. I was like, I actually had a choice between USC and NYU, and
terrible choice.
Well, it was a terrible choice. I mean, how do you choose between the two best? But I'm so much more European. So New York was, first of all, it's a shorter air trip. And second of all, I like seasons. There's something disturbing about California where it's always sunny.
Nah, it's all 72 every day.
Yeah, exactly. But I really felt like that my heart was in European storytelling. So I think New York University was the right choice for me.
Interesting. And when was this? This is early 90s?
Early 90s, yeah.
Okay, great time to be. I was living in downtown Waverly Place around that time. Great time to be there. So you're talking about European storytelling. You think that's your calling, but you decided to go to a U.S. school. Is it that just that's the way you go? That's the place? I mean, obviously, USC and NYU have great reputations historically. Is there a chance to take a path that here, you know, a Swedish path?
Well, I could, but the Swedish film school only accepts 4 students every other year.
Ooh. Every other year?
Yeah, or at least it was at that time. And I felt that I've always somehow perform better in American schools. I think there's a different way of teaching. And I really like the idea of being in a big school with a lot of input, a lot of different opinions. And then I also really thought it would be nice to live go back to New York and live there for a few years. I wasn't sure where I wanted to end up, if I wanted to live in Sweden or in America.
A few questions about that film school experience. I mean, is it consuming film and learning all from that perspective? Is it hands-on, you know, producing all the time? And what's the actual sort of making of the sausage experience?
NYU at that time, it still is actually. The first year, I really thought I was only going for a year, because what they did was they had very big classes the first year, and you would have something called the MOS year, mit out sound. So you worked totally without any sound. You made silent movies.
Oh, wow.
On very simple equipment with the simplest light package you could imagine. And you really learned storytelling from its very, very basic. And then for the second year, they kicked out a lot of people, and also a lot of people quit because they felt they had gotten what they wanted, or they felt like they could learn by being in the industry or whatever reason. And I always thought that I wouldn't be allowed to continue. So I thought I'd go back and work in the Swedish film industry again after 1 year, immersive studies in storytelling. But then I was accepted in for the second year. And that's when we started with sound. And what we did was we had rotating crews. So the first year you learn how to shoot, you learn how to direct, you learn how to light, and you learn how to production manage. And some people who came into directing school realized that they really wanted to be camera people instead. Other people realized they wanted to be writers. And camera people sometimes realized they wanted to be directors. And I felt even more convinced that I wanted to be a director and that I wanted to work with actors. So the second year, I also started taking acting lessons in order to understand the acting process.
I definitely have some questions about working with actors for you that we're going to get to. I think that's fascinating on two levels. First, that they give you such exposure across sort of all of filmmaking, but also that they sort of tie your hand and make you focus on the visual for that first year. That's a very interesting approach. I wasn't aware that was the way they did it at NYU.
No, I think it was a brilliant way of forcing you to really see that you're working in a visual medium and that film is about doing, not telling. And I still think that applies, even though you can have lots of interesting dialogue, and maybe sometimes TV is more dialogue-based. Acting is still so much about doing. And the contradiction between what you're doing and what you're saying.
And there's the falling back on cliches, soundtrack elements and things like that. You can't do any of that. So you're forced to really focus in on the storytelling.
Exactly.
Very interesting. So you finish school, you come back to Sweden then to start work?
Well, it took me 5 years to finish school because I couldn't really afford to do NYU. And they didn't have any really good post-production facilities. So what I did was I shot my second-year-old movie, my year movie, and then I went back to Sweden and worked as an assistant editor so that I could use the Steenbeck in the evening.
Okay. Practical.
Very practical. And so I continued editing my own film. And then the Swedish film school were really helpful and let the students there mix my films, which was really nice.
So are you doing shorts at this time?
Exactly, or what kind of... Yeah. When I went to film school, they never asked you to do anything more than shorts. Now I know that some film schools ask their students to make a feature as a final film, which would have, I don't think I could have pulled that economically.
So the burden as a student, you have to take on some of the financial burden to
totally,
do the project.
Totally. Oh, that's one of the big differences between the States and, or New York at least, and Sweden, the Swedish film school, which is why it was such an economic help that I was allowed to mix my films here. And also one of the reasons why I all the time worked on features here in order to be able to use the facilities.
I mean, it's a really high hurdle to put up for a student, but I guess at the same time, it's really like a hard life lesson in filmmaking that you get as a result.
Yeah, being in the film business is really hard, and of course, once you get budgets, you start having other problems instead.
Luxury problems. So when you do get through school after 5 years, you start producing, you start working on a TV series, Nathan's Barn, you're doing some shorts. How do you fall into that? How do you fall into those first kind of gigs?
I came back and started working as an editor on commercials and industrials. And then I wrote a 30-minute short. And then I sent my final film to the film companies, and
what was that called?
It was my student film. What was it called? I can't even remember.
Come on, your baby. This was your life for 5 years.
It was my life. I remember the poster, but I can't remember the title.
It's okay. We'll come back to it when it pops up.
Jimmy's Day. It was called
Jimmy's Day. Okay.
And it was about a man who thought he was going to be the next big hot thing as an author, and he was rejected and he didn't dare to go home. So he spent a night in New York meeting a woman, going to Central Park in the middle of the night and facing his failure. And I sent it to the two major studios at that time, which was SF, and then there was a company called Sandrews, and mm-hmm. Katinka Farago, who was Bergman's producer, saw it, and SF said no, and she said, I think you know something about actors, I think this is interesting, do you want to do a feature? And I said no, and she was totally shocked and said, how come? And I said, because I don't think I'm ready, I don't think my thesis film was good enough, I would like to make another short.
Can I just say, this is very interesting, because I mean, obviously a lot of people at this moment are like looking for any opportunity. And if someone says feature, you just, yes, all right, fine, I'll figure it out. I mean, I get a lot of that when I'm meeting people.
Yeah.
It's very interesting that you have this self-instinct that maybe not yet.
But because I had seen over the years that I was in the business, so many people who were allowed to do one feature. And then if they didn't succeed, they weren't allowed back in.
Okay, so much was at stake, you realize.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I really felt like I wanted to do something that was more properly structured. So I wrote a 30-minute film and called Ingen som du. It's called There's No You. The title is based on a Doris Day song, There's No You. And we applied for financing, and we got that from the Swedish Film Institute, and we shot it. And that film just, opened at Gothenburg Film Festival in front of the opening film. And they actually had it running on the cinemas too as a single show, 30-minute single show. So that kind of opened the doors.
So now you are a director in the Swedish scene.
Yes. With that. And then I was offered to do a feature, and I said no again, and did a 4x30 minutes TV series instead. And then I finally felt like, okay, now I dare to do my first feature.
Can we talk about that first feature? So that's Veranda for a Tenor.
Yeah, Waiting for the Tenor in English.
Waiting for the Tenor in English. And it's interesting to me in a lot of aspects. First of all, you wrote it.
No, I co-wrote it with the author of the novel.
You co-wrote it with the author of the novel. So, I mean, there's a lot of ownership there, you know, in just that element of it. And it's a period piece, you know, your first... You said in the late 50s, early 60s?
Well, it's a mixture. It's a story about a writer and an old actor. They're very old friends, and they meet up in a bar late one night. And the actor, before he dies, wants to write his life story. And that is in the present time. But then through the whole writing process, they go back to the 50s, to their childhood. So it's a mixture between present day and the 50s. And what I did was I did present day in black and white and the past in color.
Wait a minute, didn't you get that backwards?
No. I thought it was much more appropriate because their childhood was much happier, and I just thought that was better.
I think it's a very interesting choice. But I think that it's also I see like a seed planted that's going to, you know, come further in Simon and the Oaks, you know, when I talk about the period elements. Mm-hmm. That's the line I was trying to draw there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I want to talk. You sort of touched on earlier, you know, about working with actors. That you said that this was something that drew you in. That you know, that was a lane that was important to you. So you wanted to put some attention there. In Waiting for the Tenor, you work with Krister Henriksen,
mm-hmm.
And he ends up getting the Gold Baguette, the, you know, Best Male Actor Award for that year for his performance.
Yeah.
Then you work with him later on again in another film, Sex, Hope, and Love.
Yeah.
And he also wins again.
I know.
For the best. So I'm wondering sort of what does it mean? I mean, a while back we had Liv Muniz up as a guest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was while you were shooting Stockholm Requiem.
Okay.
And she, from a performer's perspective, talked about how important it was to have familiarity with the director, with you and Karin Follin,
mm-hmm.
and how like she had this trust level that you knew her range better than she did, so you could take her places.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a director's perspective, do you think you have that kind of influence on Krister's performance?
I definitely think with Krister, I think with actors of his range, I think with any actor, but especially with actors who have reached some kind of fame and who also are, the more famous they are, the more afraid they get, because, of course, the more is at stake. And I think with Krister specifically, it was about pushing him, because he... he has so much talent, but the role was so demanding that I really needed to push him out of his comfort zone. And I think that is, yeah, maybe that is something that I do. I don't let actors get their fear in between them and the piece. I trust that they can go further than they might think that they can go.
That sounds like it might be set up some interesting moments on the set when you're sort of challenging those limits.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think people react with anger, with fear, with defiance. And usually, it's just a matter of standing there and taking it and saying. Or not saying that much, just being there and saying, I know you can do it.
Let the storm blow
over. Yeah. And I think the worst thing that you can do is back down. If you're wrong, you can admit that you're wrong. But if you see that a lot of it is just fear, then you just have to stand there and be trusting.
Yeah, but wrong, I work with the software development, so wrong, learning, all that, that's nature. But in filmmaking, you know, wrong bets are very costly, you know, if you waste a day here and there with the whole crew.
Well, so, I waste a day, that only exists in American movies. I'm talking about an hour. Wasting an hour is bad enough. No, I just mean, like, if I'm asking for a specific actress choice and it just doesn't give the performance that we wanted, then of course, okay, we went down the wrong path. But usually I usually say to everybody that there are no wrongs, there are only new rights. If we go down a path and it doesn't give what we want, okay, then we know that, then we go down another path. But like with Krister, for example, there can be a lot of fights, a lot of discussions, but usually, like I say, it's just fear. And it's just a way of reaching beyond the fear.
And going back to the fact that you're contributing also on the writing level often on your projects, does that help you in your sort of, I don't want to say control, but in your direction, you know, in your directing work, to have a hand in the writing? You know, how does it help you form your overall delivery of what you're doing? I mean,
it helps me because it helps me both write and also understand the needs of the character and what's at stake in the scene. Because many times when you get writing, it could be brilliant writing, but not very clear needs of the characters. And when I go in and do the writing myself, then I can really work on getting the whole line from the very first line to the last line to be as dynamic as possible. I mean, that's always what you're aiming for, to get as much dynamic between where the character starts off and where it ends up. If I don't write something, then I just have to really deep read it so that I understand what the characters want at each moment. Because that's what I can contribute with as a director when they're doing it. It's like, where am I going? Where do I come from? What is my need here? What's keeping me back from it? I have to know all those things, you know, especially since you never film in anything like chronological order. So I'm the one who has to envision what comes before and what comes after and give that to actors. And especially these days when we barely have time to rehearse, I'm the only one who has the whole story in my head. And the actors have to trust me so much more than in the theater, where they actually grow into the whole process.
Have the time to work around the table for days and weeks.
Yeah, and where they take responsibility for their whole line of action.
Can I ask, so Christer Henriksen, two very successful cooperations, you know, with him. Do you have an ensemble of people, like a go-to team that you like to work with when you spin up a project?
No, simply because I do so different things all the time. I mean, of course, there are actors that I love to work with them, but I work with so many different types of characters that I don't usually end up looking for the same type of roles.
I want to get into a couple, or sort of also the difference between sort of inheriting a franchise with momentum, characters, and all of that, like Beck versus, you know, the more blank canvas of your own feature film. You know, and how you impact that on the edges as a director. But before we get there, can we stop and talk a little bit about Simon and the Oaks? I found this, I rented it the other day. What a beautiful film. What a beautiful film. I had moments where I had to stop. There's some long shots that you do of the boys on their bicycle, and you shoot it across this sort of recently plowed, muddy field. And it's kind of dull. It's not even the colors are beautiful, but it's almost Van Gogh. It's just there's so many beautiful moments like this in this film. First of all, it must have been such a challenge. I mean, this feels big. This whole film. How did this come about? And how much time did it take to sort of get this off the ground from your first involvement to sort of seeing it in the theaters? And take me through the journey.
Well, it was a very strange journey in many ways, and I was definitely not involved the whole way. When I was like 2 years out of film school or something, it was the first time I heard the rumors that they were going to try to make this into a TV series. And I remember very bravely just contacting, maybe it was a few years after, contacting the Danish producer, Per Holst, and telling him that I was very interested and that I had my own relationship to the book and in many ways, and I wanted to tell him that I was interested in directing it. And he just basically dismissed me and said that Susanne Bier was going to do it. And then nothing came of it, that. And then I didn't hear anything about it. And once in a while, I heard that somebody was going to make it. And, you know, it's like that. And then when I was a commissioner, the film was finally going to be made. And I was really happy about it. It was Björn Runge who was going to make it.
Can I say, when you were a commissioner?
I was a film commissioner for feature films at the Swedish Film Institute.
Okay.
For 3 years. And So I was going to commission it, and I was really happy about it. And the script was very big, but they were working. It was a really good screenwriter, and they were doing very well. But Bjorn, unfortunately, just he and the producers had some issues, and it just was a relationship that didn't work out. So after a year of development, he left the project. And so the project died, and then the producers started looking for people, and they were going all over Scandinavia. And then one day they came and said, would you like to do it?
I've been waiting for your call.
Well, no, I hadn't really thought that way because I was the commissioner for it. And even when it died, to me, it was like I had other things going on in my life. I was the commissioner.
I actually, does that put you in an odd position?
It put me in a very odd position. So the first thing I said was, don't call me, call my boss, because I can't really tell you if you're even allowed to ask me that question, even though the project is dead. I once have supported it, and they called, and it was Cissi Elvin and Charlotta Denbird, and they were like, oh yeah, of course, and that's wonderful, and that's great. And they said, of course you're going to do it. And then the shit hit the storm, or the shit hit the fan is what you say. And everybody thought that I was like giving money to myself, which I of course wasn't, because everything had to start from the beginning. We had to apply for the money again. The financing had to start a whole new time.
So there were no guarantees.
There was definitely no guarantees. Of course not. And I, of course, had to go in and do my take on the script, and it was way too big anyway. And then when I realized that the money wasn't at all enough, we had to go in. So it took us quite a while to get it going. And I think I did like 13 rewrites on it. And then we finally...
Over time, how much time are we talking about? How many years?
It was about a year.
Okay.
And then we finally got it off the ground. There were nine producers from five different countries. I used to say to the crew that this is the biggest low-budget film you've ever worked on.
Well, I think I know what you mean here. Act as if it's low budget, but we're going to try to get as much resources as we can into it.
I mean, basically, we had to make the right choices the first time around. We had to plan everything so in such detail because we didn't have that much money, but it had to look like we had that much money.
That certainly does look like you have a lot of money.
We shot it in Gothenburg and outside of Gothenburg and in Hamburg and in Berlin. We ended up with, I think, a 60-day shoot. And it was my life partner who shot it, Dan Lausen. So that was the second time around we worked together. It was a long editing process, and then finally came out.
So the biggest challenges were sort of the pre-shoot parts of it, getting everything in place to be able to get those 60 days, or?
No, I think the whole shoot was an enormous, enormous challenge because we had to cover four seasons in only one winter and one spring and one summer week. So everything was a huge challenge. We were very fortunate that the winter was probably one of the coldest winters ever with so much snow. So we got all the snow pictures in, and then the spring was very long. And then we had to get the oak. You know how many oaks I found?
Casting your tree.
Oh my god, we looked for oaks, and actually around that, you know, where we talked about that bicycle shot, right around the corner from there we found an oak and we were like, okay, this is great. And then we were standing there looking at it one day when we were going to shoot a few shots of it, just with a very small crew. And we saw a little island way out. And we were like, there's an oak out there. Because what we learned was that in the film, the oak is supposed to be by the water, but oaks hate wind. Mm. So they don't grow by the water. But then we found...
So these are an actor's not working with you. See
I know. And so I found this little tiny island where only cows walk. It's like a little cow bridge over to it, where there was a huge oak tree. And it was so stunning and so beautiful and so impractical. But this wonderful producer, Christer Nilsson, he realized that, yeah, it was it. It was worth all the inconvenience because it was so majestic.
I think the whole film is so powerful and just beautiful. How was it received? I mean, did it echo outside of Sweden at all?
Yes, it did. It got very good reviews in both the LA Times and New York Times. It had a run in New York. And it has been distributed all over the world.
Yeah, and it's available online if anyone wants to dial it up. I recommend it.
I still get... people who add on to it and from the Facebook page.
Well, it's a touching story. I mean, I can see it would resonate. There's timelessness to that, even though there's a historic element.
And of course, it had a lot of nominations. And unfortunately, it wasn't. I think it was a shame that it wasn't Sweden's Oscar nomination. I think it would have had a chance, but. Those, you know, you can't control those things.
Hmm. Oh, interesting. What would have unfolded had it been?
Yeah.
Let's move on. I mean, if you don't mind, to Beck. You know, this is why I reached out to you because you know you're responsible for, I guess, the most recent 4 installments in the franchise. 2 that came out last year.
Two of the last. Every time there are 2 directors on. So I did 2 last year, and then the year before that, and then two of the ones that are coming now.
Coming now, yeah. So 4 altogether. Okay. And this is the 25th anniversary of Beck in its current incarnation. I mean, it's fascinating. You call it a TV series. I mean, it's not, you're doing long form here, you know, more than episodic television.
Yeah.
And like as alluded to earlier, this is long running, but you're the first woman to be handed sort of the direction reins here. And as much as I wish this wasn't even worth talking about at, you know, year 2022, I think there's something meaningful about it, given the genre, especially. I mean, does coming at this as a female director, is that something that you're aware of when you take the responsibility, or is it just irrelevant to you?
Well, to me, it's irrelevant because I've never been a man. I don't know how I would have done it differently if I was a man.
Yeah, but all the work before you was done by men, and so
yeah. But I haven't looked at all the work. I only looked at the recent ones, and the Beck franchise has developed from being much more crime focused, being much more 80s and or 90s with a lot of blood and a lot of gory murders, especially female murders. And it has more and more ranged into social and psychological cases, and the ensemble has changed too. And so I felt like it was closer to my aesthetics now than it used to be in the beginning, when it was much more violent and bloody and less psychological. But I really don't know if it is a male-female thing in terms of storytelling. I think it's more a male-female thing in terms of the producers really still being in some kind of old-fashioned perception of women not being able to do action.
Okay.
I think they have at least they had this idea that we're not comfortable with anything that involves a lot of technical aspects.
That's quite dismissive.
Well, but I don't think that it's something they're aware of. I just think that is the way, that is one of the reasons why so few women are allowed or asked to do action series and crime series, though it has changed a lot the last few years.
So you're not trying to deliberately introduce any sort of female tones. You're just bringing yourself to this as a woman.
I'm just bringing myself to it as a director. And I happen to be very interested in character development, even though I love action as well. I still want, when I watch crime series, I want to invest myself psychologically into the characters as well as see the crime being solved or the mystery being solved. So that's what I brought with me.
But as I kind of alluded to, feature films give you more of a blank page,
Yeah. You
know, to sort of fill what's going on. The Beck franchise has momentum in terms of story, in terms of cast. So as a director, how is your influence different than sort of when you have a feature film? Are you casting the sort of the villain sort of as a rule or?
When I started last year, the character Joseph was totally new. And I didn't cast him, but it was basically our job to find the character. And of course, they had a vision of who he was, but it was our job to find it. And when you go into a series that already exists, you have to pay homage to and be very respectful to the genre and basically when people turn on the television, if it says Beck, they are expecting a Beck. So what you have to do is you have to emerge your own sensibilities into that franchise. Because every year has to be new, because otherwise the Beck audience wouldn't stay. You can't repeat yourself and do old films, but you still have to be able to recognize yourself. You still have to be able to say, yeah, this is a Beck film.
So evolve it, but gently.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you take over, there are some really motivated Beck fans out there who've been following this throughout the years, who are hanging, waiting, you know, for the next drop. What kind of response did you get on your sort of first efforts?
Well,
do people think that you handled it respectfully?
Well, obviously,
did they challenge
they were
you?
The two most viewed films, so some people must have liked it. They were number one and number two on Seymour's list of most seen films.
Congratulations! That's the people have spoken.
The people have spoken, but I have to say, I was given two very good scripts, Stefan Thunberg and Fredrik Algetoft wrote the two episodes, so the two features that I did last year, and they were very good, compelling stories, and very different from each other, which I also think is one of the nice things with the brand Beck, that you never know what kind of story it is. Every film is totally free from the one before.
Except there is the red thread of our crew and some expectation.
Exactly.
It's nice. But I would say, you know, bringing us to your latest, Femti Otto Minuto.
Which is really different.
Exactly. very much breaks form and sort of instead of the whodunit, it's the here and now, what's happening.
I know. It's talk about challenging our Beck viewers.
I would say challenging right off the start. The cold start had me wondering, should I be switched? What's going on? What am I watching? But it made me lean in. It hooked me
I'm glad.
Away.
You didn't just turn it off. That would have been terrible.
No, but it forced me to raise my level of engagement from the jump, you know, to start trying to figure out what that moment was, what was happening. And exciting all the way through. I mean, we talked ahead of this that we said we'll try to be spoiler aware. We talk a little bit about this. So if you haven't seen it and you're really concerned, you can tune out now. But there's a hostage drama, and there's a real time element to this that really raises the dramatic stakes. I'm wondering how you go about this. So you get this, you know the story, you have the concept. Do you sort of, you know, look at hostage films? Do you dial up Dog Day Afternoon or King of Comedy? Do you look at 24? I mean, how do you
all
sort
of those?
Yeah,
all of those and a few more.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, because that's it's not like direct lines, but there's some kind of resonance from all of this in my mind as I'm watching all of the as I'm watching
it's
your show.
It's funny
unfold.
Because Dog Day Afternoon was the first one that I turned to. Was the first one that I turned to, and of course I realized that times have changed, and I don't know how much, but there are some great moments in that, and I just like the whole idea, you know, the Stockholm syndrome.
I was going to ask Norrmalm's Torg Bank Robbery. Do you dig up the history?
You know, just the whole idea of how if you spend enough time in a room with someone, you start seeing all the different qualities.
Oh, well, there are layers to your protagonist, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought, I mean, a protagonist who only has one layer, you wouldn't want to spend 1.5 hours with. So you really have to keep on wondering, what is at stake? Why is this person doing this? And of course, you don't want to have an easy answer to that.
Motivation.
Mm-hmm. And so I looked at Dog Day Afternoon, and of course I looked at King of Comedy, of course. What was the third one you mentioned?
I just thought about Norrmalm's Torg in the Stockholm.
Yeah. But then we just had to, it still was a lot about, for me, giving place to the big characters. That was one of the big challenges, to make sure that it still felt like a Beck film.
Yeah, it certainly gave room for Alex, but I guess the challenge was, how do you keep everyone else sort of front and center?
Both that, and also to give Alex some kind of agency, some kind of because she could very easily just become a passive hostage. But here she had to actually have issues and try to see what she could do to change the situation.
She's definitely not passive.
I'm glad you say that.
I have a couple of questions around it. You alluded earlier to how, you know, when you shoot, you rarely do things in chronological order. As most or a big chunk of this is sort of real time, did you shoot that out of sequence, or did you try to do that chronologically?
That part we did chronologically. Otherwise, it would have been too difficult.
How do you just get the
time? We shot over, I think, a period of 6 days. Mad 6 days, where we kept on getting backlashes because of Corona and actors being sick, and we could do a whole episode just about how it is shooting with Corona. But somehow we got all we needed.
You certainly did. Really nice. Getting back to sort of like where you influenced sort of casting, there's a police woman who sort of takes control on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Is she a new character?
Yeah.
I mean, I've only watched maybe a handful of these, so
yeah,
I can't be sure.
Yeah, she's a new character. She's a one-time character.
First of all, I don't know if I've seen her in anything else. She for me is like the raw nerve of this. You know, the tension resonates through her as it grows. Who is she? Where did you find
Maya
her?
Rung. I saw Maya Rung the first time at Stadstheatern for many years, and then I've just followed her on theater. I think she's a brilliant actress. And I just really wanted to do something very different with the police in control, especially after seeing all these American hostage films. There's always like this disillusioned, a little bit overweight guy with a trench coat coming in, say,
central casting, central casting.
Give me a phone. Okay, are we hooked up now? Hi, my name is...
I'm the only one allowed to talk
exactly,
to him.
Exactly.
My jurisdiction, yeah. My jurisdiction.
So I thought, let's go the other way, especially also because this is an international show. It has a big audience in the States. It has a big audience all over the world. And I think it's really something that suddenly is much more interesting to see a young woman in charge.
Mm-hmm. And not 100% self-assured,
exactly.
Very human
exactly.
In the moment.
Which is a really interesting thing because I've, during my time of working these years, I've seen the progression from not being able to have any female protagonists at all, always having male protagonists, and then we've slowly developed into having female protagonists, but for a while, every female lead had to be so self-assured and so perfect and could never show any weaknesses. And now I think we finally come to a point where we can show women in a very multifaceted way without getting like the blame game of, oh, why are you showing women weak, da, da, da. We are finally coming to a point where women and men are allowed to be complex characters, which is, I don't know why we're talking about this 2022, but
yeah,
things don't happen.
Thank you. Now we can have adult
storytelling. Now we can
thank
have
you.
Adult storytelling. We can start getting somewhat close to literature's complex characters.
And as great as that ensemble is, she really stuck out for me.
Oh,
somehow.
I'm so glad to hear that. I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah, I think she's wonderful. And I think her face, she has so few lines, really. So it's...
But again, she's the raw nerve of what's happening. She's telling me that where the drama is. Like, it just something about her resonates that mm-hmm. to me. So what are you expecting now when this is going to come out to the world in a couple of weeks? Everyone's on edge. Seymour's pumping it up. People are writing about it all over the place. We said it's the 25th anniversary, so you know Beck is in focus everywhere. You nervous? I mean, it's a little out of pace, as you said, sort of a little unexpected in the storytelling and the approach to Beck, even though it holds true to sort of everything. There's the little political undertones that sort of have gone in older stories, but it does break a little bit, you know, in the approach. What are you expecting in a response?
Oh, I'm sure there will be a lot of people who hate it, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who love it. To me, it's kind of like once the whole I've made all my choices, I can't really do anything different.
Yeah, you're done.
Yeah, so. Once I've given up all the choices, once I've mixed it and screened it and controlled it and done everything, I'm like, well, it's kind of like my kids, they're grown up now. I can't really take responsibility for them anymore.
It's just nice when you reflect back.
I just
well
feel
on
like
you.
There are some really nice acting moments in there. And I think it is a compelling story. And I think it is a story that also is politically interesting.
It injects a different level of adrenaline than the normal
yeah.
Beck storytelling, you know.
So, but I'm very curious as to how it works, because it is an experiment in many ways. And I hope the feedback reaches me. I mean, many times as a TV director, you don't really get the input. So I hope I will get feedback.
Oh, that's interesting. So the producers or the distributors don't necessarily gather everything and deliver it to you as a package. Here's all the calls.
Yeah,
the
No.
Yeah. So this is coming out in a couple of weeks from when we're recording this. You have a second installment, is that completed as well, or are you still working? So you're done. So what's next for you then? These are in the rear view.
I'm writing a TV series, drama comedy, and I will actually be directing theater next.
Oh, what will that be and where?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say it.
I guess
by the time this is out, it will be at Intiman in Stockholm. And it's a crime mystery.
Okay. It's a classic, something you've written?
No, it's not something I've written. I wish I could say what it was, but it's a crime mystery. It involves a big discussion about power, about sexuality, and about what money does to people.
Are you working on it right now?
Yeah.
Is it sort of pre-production? Yeah. Okay. Exciting. And do you do this sort of deliberately to sort of just change the palette from film and TV to theater, or is it just the flow of the opportunities? How do you manage that?
It's basically just the flow of opportunities, but I like it because, like I said, I love working with actors. So doing theater once in a while is really getting back to the basics. There's nothing that you can't protect yourself with fancy camera moves or great editing. It just has to be there. The acting has to deliver.
So challenging yourself in a different lane, building up that muscle again in a different way.
Yeah.
Interesting. I won't keep you much longer. We're kind of getting to the end of our allotted time. Thanks very much for taking the time. As I said, I thoroughly enjoyed working my way through your catalog over the last week or so. And I feel really honored to have had a pre-peek at the Femti Otto Minuto. It was exciting. It was unexpected in delightful ways, you know, so I'm waiting to see what the response is. I think it's going to really resonate.
Well, I hope so. And thank you so much. Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And it was wonderful talking to you.
Yeah, tremendous work. Thank you again. That was fun. I thought Lisa gave some really thoughtful answers. Have to be impressed with the breadth of her directing work across TV, film, and stage. Once again, I particularly enjoyed Simon in the Oaks or Simono Ekkona. I'd recommend it to anyone who likes a period drama. And in a completely different genre, I believe that her latest take on Beck, Femti Otto Minuto, will surprise and delight longtime fans. I hope that you enjoyed meeting Lisa as much as I did. We'll be back soon with another episode of Stream Close Up.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.